Now on RTE Radio 1, time for this week's Countrywide with Ella McSweeney.
Good morning and welcome to Countrywide. Coming up for you at before nine, Navy gabardine, medical bag and bicycle, the role of midwives in rural Ireland, honeybees in Limerick and wild bees in Mayo, and taking the plunge in County Galway. It is 51551 for your texts. Countrywide at rte.ie is our email. And we've already got a text in from someone saying, fabulous morning in Castlereagh, County Roscommon. Sun is shining. I thought they were joking, but it actually is shining. But I hate to tell you, the rain is on its way. So if you're in Castlereagh this morning, get all your shopping and all your bits done before, what is it looking at? 11 o'clock this morning when the rain is due. And it has, of course, been such a chaotic year for weather. We've had a very wet spring. We've had a drought in parts of the country by May. The hottest June on record. And now it's been the wettest July on record. And we non-farmers in Ireland can travel through these conditions as best we can. But for farmers, well, they have to manage their stock and their crops in the face of it. But they are adept at doing this. So how are things going and what can be done? Well, we're going to take it a flavour from farmers across the country this morning. I'm joined this morning by Andrew Bergen, tillage farmer in Kildare. Eamon Carroll, a dairy farmer in Tipperary. Padraig McCormack, who grows spinach, lettuce leaves and herbs as part of his McCormack family farm in Meath. And Anne Gleeson-Hanrahan in Offaly. She's a contractor and the managing director of the Association of Farm and Forestry Contractors in Ireland. They do work on behalf of farmers. Good morning to all of you. Padraig, I'm going to start with you. I was in the supermarket yesterday. I bought my lettuce and my spinach. On this side of the fence, it all looks fine. How has it been for you in the field?
It has been quite a turmoil, to be honest with you. Yes, it all looks great on the shelf and people don't think twice, but I think we're after having the hardest 3 months of our life, literally, in the Irish season.
Really?
To be honest with you, our main motto is Irish produce on the shelves between June to mid-October. But it's quite a struggle right now.
And just describe, if you can, your fields and the kind of efforts that you have to go to now, given the wet weather.
Well, to be very honest with you, the optimism that you carry every day, hoping and praying that everything's going to evolve to what it should be, literally now even to get into the fields, never mind to get to harvest, is a massive issue. Every day we're planning ahead, but we never get to the field in that day. And if we do, literally, it's a slog in such a way that certain fields are just not able to travel. The machines are not able to harvest in it. And literally, if you do get in, you're getting a quarter of your volume due to quality, etc. Because it's no different than having your lovely house plant at home. If you water it every day, it's just going to diminish and go yellow. So when you're looking at thousands of kilos of product, ready, fit, beautiful, lying flat, that the machines can't cut or can't travel. And then, of course, being wet is a big issue for us because it's so hard to pack.
And I can hear the weariness in your voice. I mean, it is not easy to wake up to a morning like this morning for you.
To be fair, the hands-on effect right now is literally sourcing product Europe to fulfill the gaps, even though we have the produce, but we can't get it literally harvested, is to fulfill our orders for our retailers and food service clients, which the demand is summertime, of course, literally very big for us. And the hands-on effect of literally acting fast, speaking to other growers in UK, Germany, Sweden, what to see for next week, because we wouldn't have programs with these other growers because our main motto is to grow the volume ourselves. Yes, we have it, but we just can't. We can't get into the fields. And talking to growers in Sweden at the moment to import baby spinach. And then you have literally the passionate consumer that's looking for Irish product actually emailing McCormick Farms, why is the product Sweden? Why is it from Germany? Why is it from the UK? your McCormick Family Farms Irish growers. You can't really say this in the wrong way. Look out your window. Nobody can even mow their lawn right now.
And of
now.
Course, you fix your contracts with the major supermarkets and the wholesalers in the
yes.
spring, and you have to fulfil that. So importing it is your only way. I want, Portic, bear with me for a second. I want to go to Kildare with Andrew Bergen there, tillage farmer. Andrew, you grow spring and winter cereals, oilseed rape and peas. Your concern this week was harvesting your milling wheat, and this is wheat for flour. If it gets wet, the quality goes down. How have you got on, Andrew?
We got the milling wheat cut yesterday evening just before the rain. Well, we got what should be the milling wheat. We'll have to do some tests today to see whether it still is. On Monday when we tested it, it was still just about making the grade. But if it gets the more wetting it gets once the seed is mature, the more that quality deteriorates. So I'm kind of on a knife edge today till I get some results there. But it's cut and it's in the shed.
Good. And you grow peas. The cans of bachelor peas are your peas. I just wonder, you know, we used to have in Ireland, and hopefully we will to a certain extent still have it, this idea of four seasons in one day. But now we have these big blocks of weather, dry drought conditions in May, and now this, you know, tumultuous rain, these sort of rapid cycle of wet and dry, hot and cold. How does it affect the likes of your peas?
Yeah, the peas are particularly vulnerable there, because once the pea pod is mature, it dries out. Like, we harvest the peas dry through a combine, so the pea pod is quite dry. Now, if it gets repeated wetting and drying, it shrinks and expands until it splits, and then the water gets in and that stains the pea. So that destroys the quality for canning, because visually it's still edible, but it doesn't look very good. They're a very tricky crop to harvest anyway, Ella. And so if we get a lot of this kind of weather and the damp ground is damp underneath, it's very hard for the crop to dry enough to go through the combine. The last Saturday here was an absolute godsend. I don't know where it came out. We had sun and wind and we flew through the peas, and I'm a new man after that.
Oh, yeah. And I presume... you know, it's hard for us non-farmers to understand this, but I mean, you're looking at the weather constantly. In a matter of 10 minutes, if you get a gap, you're out there and you're at work.
You are, certainly. And to be fair, like, weather forecasts haven't improved the weather, but they've made it a whole lot easier for us to know what's coming. And they're so much better than they were. Like, we're quite accurate. And yeah, because we're planning 10 days ahead is about as far as you can go with that. But you really, it's like a military operation now, this harvest, because compared to the last couple of years when we'd find weather and you could be like a Frenchman, you know, go out after your dinner and cut a bit and come in and have a glass of wine. It's not like that this year. Everyone is just hanging around waiting for opportunities, afraid to do anything. And crops are deteriorating in the fields. You know, that milling quality is going. Yeah. A lot of most malt and barley is still to be cut. And again, that's the same thing. That malt and barley needs to germinate to make malt. So if it begins to even think about germinating in the field, it can fail for malt. And that's a big drop in your income
because you're not paid the premium. I want to go to Tipperary, Eamon Carroll, dairy farmer there. Eamon, how are you getting on? Did you manage to get out and cut the grass a second time to make silage?
Yeah, good morning, Ella. I suppose like your previous two speakers there, you know, we're being challenged all the time. I suppose a bit like the rest of them there, you know, our challenge actually started last October, in that when last year would have had been a good year per se, but the back end of the year then got very challenging, you know.
It was a long winter. It was a long winter, wasn't it?
In the long winter, yeah. We had, I suppose, in October was very, very wet. November was a washout. We traditionally wouldn't be housing stock until the end of November, early December. I think we had everything housed last year in around the 8th of November. So, you know, rolled that on during the winter months, and we normally would be out again with stock in fields in around the 10th of March, thereabouts, maybe a bit earlier. We didn't get out this year until around the 10th of April.
And of course, all that means that you're feeding your cows inside, and all of that is just extra money out, isn't it? I want Eamon, just bear with me again there, just to go to Offaly with Anne Gleeson Hanrahan, the contractor, because Anne, you were out cutting silage yesterday. It's been a very stop-start year, hasn't it?
It has been a very stop year. Yes, I was out cutting silage yesterday, but the ground conditions are poor enough now, but we managed okay. We got it done. It has been a difficult year for agriculture contractors. Work kind of has to be in a stop-start with weather conditions, going from rainfall to drought and back to one of the wettest Julys on record. As in earlier in the year, in February, like it was earlier than usual, beans was especially sown as weather conditions was reasonably good. Then it came, of course, to March, which very little tillage work was carried out.
And of course, it plays havoc with your staff, doesn't it? Because you have weeks where they can't do much and you're trying to hold on to them as well.
That's correct. It does. It plays havoc with your staff, is right. Because like you could say, for example, you could maybe have one day this week that you're, say, out on the land working, and then the rest of the week, then they're kind of in the yard and you're trying to do maintenance work and you're trying to hold on to them. And they are skilled staff, and you do need to be out on the fields and working.
And the other thing as well is these agri-environmental schemes and schemes in general where the departments say, look, you can't do this until this date. In terms of acres, the agri-environmental scheme, farmers were asked not to cut grass until the first week in July for the benefit of nature. This is becoming increasingly unworkable in the face of climate change, isn't it?
It is, like especially this year. Because anyone who have joined a new acre scheme, as you said, they're not allowed to cut their silage or hay until the 1st of July, which especially the north, or say the west and the northwest, it turned out to be a disaster because they actually couldn't cut their silage or hay. They couldn't apply slurry and they've had to turn around and bring their stock back in, which is going to create a food shortage and a slurry management problem.
Well, here I presume for the four of you, here's hoping for a bit of stability in the weather in terms of sunshine and get a bit of what they have in Castlereagh and Roscommon this morning. Andrew Bergen in Kildare, Eamon Carroll in Tipperary, Pádraig McCormack in Meath and Anne Gleeson Hanrahan in Offaly. Thank you all so much for joining us this morning. Now, we are going to something completely different. We're going to bees. The dark European honeybee, known here as the black bee, was found across Europe, but it's now no longer prevalent. But it's doing all right here in Ireland. The black bee population is considered pure and distinct, and they're well adapted to living in our climate, or what they thought was our climate. Their breeding season is short to fit in with our summers. Well, 3 years ago, Hannah Quinn Mulligan started to keep them on her farm in Limerick. By the end of June, the hives were doing very well in the sun. But of course, the rain in the last month has caused problems. She took advantage of a dry spell in more recent days and went down to the hives to see how they're getting on.
You don't expect to find starving honeybees in late summer. At least I didn't. But walking across the garden one morning, I could tell that something was up. From one little hive, I could see one wasp and then another wasp. A sly interloper zooming in and out. A slight puff of smoke, then another to calm the insects. And gently, I prized off the lid. I had to take a moment and take in the sight. Sharp, black and yellow wasps were guzzling the remaining honey in the hive, while under the wooden frames there were bodies of hundreds of little black bees curled up on top of each other, motionless in the fetal position. Upset, I shooed the wasps away and closed up the hive. I tell myself that perhaps because it had been a nuke, a baby hive, that it had a slimmer chance of survival. The last time I checked the hives was 4 weeks ago, when they were laden with honey. But since then, the broken weather meant that they couldn't get out. They ate all their honey reserves and grew too weak to fight off any wasp attacks. But going to the next hive and the next ones, the ones that should be stronger, I'm met with the same eerie silence. There is something not just sad, but gut-wrenchingly apocalyptic about finding dead bees. Seeing their little bodies, usually so busy with industry in summer months, motionless, makes it feel like something has been broken. Something is off kilter. And I'm not able to fix it. I'm not able to bring the bees back. Walking on, my final hive stands out amongst the others. It's painted a garish Barbie pink and stands three stories or supers tall. It's a skyscraper of the bee world. Last time I inspected it, it was teeming with industry, with honey and comb and baby bee making all taking place at rapid speed simultaneously. Nervously this time, I lift off the lid. My whole body relaxes because finally there's that familiar deep hum of hundreds upon hundreds of bees. Easily 60,000. But the tone of their buzz was different. As a farmer, you instinctively know the sweet, soft, cooing low that a cow will make to her calf, compared to that bellow of fear or hunger she can make. Now, I won't claim to be a bee expert, but this was the first time that the hum of the bees didn't sound happy to be busy. It sounded panicked. It sounded like time was running out. Carefully, I restored the layers of the hive and tipped the sugar syrup that I'd made into the bee feeder at the top. The little black bodies swarmed into the feeder immediately and eagerly sucked up the syrup. When I returned later in the day, the hive was quiet. A hard rain had started to fall that afternoon and the bees were unable to get out. And nearly all of that sugar syrup that I'd given them earlier was gone. Now there's a school of thought in beekeeping that you shouldn't mollycoddle bees. You should let weaker hives die and let stronger hives remain. Those are the laws of nature. But nature has been through a funny time this year. And while I can live without a harvest of honey, I can't afford to lose my bees. So I'm choosing to feed them and mollycoddle them all through this summer, autumn and winter, and well into next spring, when hopefully the rain will stop, the sun will shine, and they can fly once again.
That's Hannah Quinn Mulligan with her native black bees on her farm in Limerick. And we will be talking with another farmer in Mayo about a different species of bee after this break.
Email countrywide at rte.ie.
Welcome back, 51551 for your text. Well, before the break, we heard how the wet weather is affecting the health of honeybees on Hannah's farm in Limerick. But overall, as long as there are beekeepers like Hannah, the honeybee should do okay. It in many ways is more like livestock than wildlife, but it is our wild bee species that need our attention. And someone who knows a lot about this and who's traipsed around all the corners of Ireland surveying them is Dara Stanley from UCD's School of Agriculture and Food Science. I'm delighted to say that Dara joins us this morning. Good morning, Dara. Dara, we have 21 species of bumblebee, 75 species of solitary bees, and scientists, you scientists have been saying for a good few years that by 2030, which is not that far away, a third of them are going to be extinct. Can you give us a picture of how things are as you know it now?
Yes, so, you know, our bees are so important to the production of our food, to the reproduction of our plants, but it's not always good news when it comes to bees, and that's because we do know that certain species are in decline. So we have data from our National Bumblebee Monitoring Scheme, we have data from our red lists that shows this. Now, we have good data for some species, but we also don't know a lot about other species, so insects in general tend to be understudied. So while we do have an overall picture of decline, there's an awful lot we don't know about certain species.
The more I read about bumblebees, the more extraordinary they become. I mean, little facts like they beat their wings, I hope I'm correct in saying this, 8,000 times a minute, which is mind-boggling. And they can fly when loaded with pollen and nectar that doubles their body weight. It's just extraordinary. You've spent your professional life looking at them. Do you have a favourite species?
I have a few favourites, but my absolute favourite, it has to be the great yellow bumblebee, Bombus distinguendus, which is it's Ireland's rarest bumblebee. It was formerly found countrywide. I've been to the collections in the museum and seen specimens of it from County Carlow in the 1920s. But now it's only found in the west of Ireland and primarily only found on the Mullet Peninsula in County Mayo. But
I think of this species as like the Marilyn Monroe of the bumblebee world. I mean, it's just extraordinary. Beautiful thing.
It's a beautiful bee. It's an absolutely beautiful bee. I sometimes call it a blonde bombshell. It's very blonde, with these lovely blonde hairs on its abdomen, on its tail, and on its thorax and kind of its back. But it has this characteristic black stripe across its back, which is how you can tell it apart from some of our other blonde species. And it's quite a large bee in comparison to other bees. It has a long tongue, which determines the types of flowers it can visit. So it likes things like knapweeds and red clovers and flowers that have slightly kind of long tubes down to their nectar. And it's also quite a late emerging species. So some of our bumblebees will emerge in March and April time, whereas the great yellow bumblebee tends to emerge a bit later in the season, June, July, and you really kind of see its peak populations around now, coming August into September. So it's an unusual bee in some of those ways as well. And it's rare in Ireland, but also in the UK. It's only found, for example, in the north of Scotland and some of the islands.
We're going to go over to Mayo, to the Mullet Peninsula now, and join Joseph Geraghty, who is a farmer out there. Good morning, Joseph.
Good morning, Ella. Good morning, Dana.
You inherited your farm in 2009. You keep sheep. You're a firefighter. You also have glamping pods for tourists there. But now you have an income from these blonde bombshell bees, don't you?
Blonde bombshells, this great yellow bumblebee project. Yeah, we have an income from that, and it helps us keep the meadows not mown, don't mow them until later in the year to provide food for the great yellow bumblebee.
There's 27 farmers over there involved. When was the first time you saw one?
First time I saw one would have been in 2020 when Dr. Karina Dingercus got in contact with me about the great yellow bumblebee project, and she had found one on my land.
And can you describe it?
Just like what Dara said there, it's a bigger bee. It's all blonde, and it has a black stripe going from wing to wing across its back. I suppose that's the best way of describing it, really.
And you still have these sort of old hay meadows that your father had as well. Is that what they like?
That's true. That seems to be what they like. I suppose my father would have farmed the farm in a traditional method, and I suppose going on then I didn't change anything really. So a lot of the flowers and grasses that they look for, like the knapweed and the clovers, kidney veg and all that, they're still intact in the hay meadows, and there's a lot of pockets of traditional hay meadow around the Mullet Peninsula and just on the edge of the town of Balmullet here where I'm located.
And for you, I mean, looking at the kind of economic side of it, is it the case that the fact that you're the last spot in Ireland to have this population, do people come and you know, stay in your glamping pods? Is it part of your sort of tourist offering as well or not?
Well, with us here at Geraghty's Farm Your Pods, we do offer that, and a lot of the tourists that come and stay, we can educate them on the different biodiversity that's in the area. Along with the great yellow bumblebee, we have Life on Macker, and we have Birdwatch Ireland, and we can educate them, and they come and go then, like they tell other people, and then they come to the area as well. So there is an ecotourism patch with it too, you know.
Dara, why have they declined so much?
So it's likely a combination of factors. Climate is potentially a factor in this particular species, but primarily one of the key drivers is probably loss of habitat. So as James was saying there, they really like hay meadows. They really like species-rich grasslands. And these grasslands have declined nationally over time, probably as we've moved from haymaking to silage production over the last century or so. So Yeah, for example, as I said, I've seen specimens of this bee from the 1920s from County Carlow, but over time it's moved further westwards. It was found in the Burren up until about 10 or 20 years ago, and now the only populations are around the Mullet, and there's been a few sightings in the north of Achill Island, which is quite exciting too. So it's primarily the lassa of the flowers that these bees feed on. We don't know much about this species in terms of where it nests, and actually trying to find bumblebee nests is very, very difficult. Some people have tried in the UK to use sniffer dogs to find them, but it's hard. So we don't know much about the nesting requirements for this species, but it's likely that there's been issues with nesting as well. And another potential factor is disease. And again, we don't know much about disease in this species, but we do know that bees suffer from disease. We do know that disease can pass between managed bees, for example, honeybees and wild bees. So that could be a factor in it as well. So it's likely climate, habitat and maybe disease.
I mean, I know over there in the Mullet, there's been so many people involved in this species. Dave Sutterby from Birdwatch Ireland, Mayo County Council, Peter Gill there. You've had agricultural advisors, Noel Walsh. You've also had Belmullet, Tidy Towns. There seems to be a whole energy behind this species. And then hopefully for farmers, they're obviously getting paid through this European Innovation Partnership, but also tourism. And Dara, for you, it's an interesting thing, isn't it? The idea that there could be an economic stream for farmers alongside the likes of getting money from the government to farm in a certain way.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's something we could probably do more of in Ireland is celebrate what we have in terms of our biodiversity. And yeah, I'm sure it's something that could be explored further. I mean, just to mention the Great Yellow Bumblebee EIP was a pilot EIP project, but only received funding for a very short time. So, you know, I think if we want these schemes to become longer term and we want them to be successful, you know, really they have to take place over a longer time period. So it'd be nice to see these things continuing.
And one of the pressures on bees, as we know, is pesticide use. And in your work, you've attached in the past radio tags to the back of bumblebees and you fed half of them low levels of pesticides. When you did that, what did you find?
Yes. So you know, when people think about bees and pesticides, they often think about the fact that pesticides can kill bees. And when I talk about pesticides, I'm primarily talking about insecticides, but fungicides and herbicides can also potentially cause issues. But what really we've begun to discover through research over the last 10 years or so is that it's not often the concern that pesticides might directly kill bees, that pesticides can have what we call these sublethal effects. So they can affect how bees behave. So some recent work that was published by one of the PhD students, Alison, in my lab, showed that when we exposed bumblebees to low levels of lambda-cyhalothrin, which is our most widely used insecticide here in Ireland at the moment, that those bees were less good at... They were less active, first of all, and they were less good at bringing pollen back to their nests. So, yeah, we find that the pesticides mightn't necessarily kill bees outright, but they can have these low-level effects, which will ultimately affect how they can reproduce and how they can survive. And
so for farmers, don't spray, for example, in the middle of the day when it's sunny.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is quite a you say relatively simple, but when you hear about the complications of doing anything in agriculture at the moment.
Indeed.
With the weather, obviously, there are limitations too. But some of our other work by a student in my lab called Arian has looked recently at times of day and how active pollinators are. And really between 10 and 6 or 10 and 5 is the most active time of the day for pollinators. So often the conditions for spraying pesticides and the conditions for optimal pollinator activity are the same. You need warm weather with low wind and so on and so forth. So, you know, if we can apply pesticides earlier in the morning, which is usually better than later in the evening from an operational point of view, that can reduce the direct contact of pollinators with pesticides. So the only thing is we don't quite know then about the residues those pesticides leave behind. So we do need further research on these mitigation measures and ways that we can reduce the impacts of pesticides on bees where they need to be used. Because, for example, you might spray pesticide in the morning, but there could be residues that stay on the plants or the flowers in the middle of the day when pollinators are active. But we just don't know enough about that yet, unfortunately.
OK, well, it's very, very heartening to hear the farmers out in the Mullet doing what they can to enhance this beautiful bee species. Dara Stanley, thank you so much for joining me this morning. And Joseph Geraghty over there in Mayo, thank you very much indeed. Now, the Sanctuary Runners was set up in Cork in 2018 as a solidarity through sport initiative, which uses running to bring together migrants, refugees, asylum seekers and Irish residents. It's now moved from the land into the sea with a first of its kind sanctuary swimmer group. And one has been set up in Galway. Della Kilroy went over to Salt Hill to take the plunge.
Where we are, first of all, it's very windy. But sunny at the same time. That's what they call Irish weather, right? But I'm looking forward to go get in the sea. I'm just so excited. Every Monday I look forward to this. And ever since I got here, I've been so interested to swim in the sea. And what's good about it? There's no sharks. Thank you so much. And another thing that makes me excited about today, the reason why I'm happy that it's windy, it's the first time seeing waves here.
That you can surf in.
It's windy here on Galway's Strand Hill, where a group of beginner swimmers are getting ready for their third of four sea swim lessons.
My name is Khumutso, but also known as KG, and I'm from South Africa. I've been in Ireland for a year now.
I'm looking, you see where the people are going right now, that distance, I'm looking to go further that way.
Before coming here, I never used to swim in the ocean. The last time I swam in the ocean was over 12 years ago. So this is more like a first time experience in so many years, and I find it so exciting.
So you're all geared up, you've got your wetsuit on, you're ready to get into the water.
Yeah, and I've got big head, so I improvised, I used two caps.
You still look good though.
I will do anything to be in that water.
How are you, Kevin? Nice to see you.
How many do we have?
Down a few people. So.
Their instructor from Swim Ireland is Kevin.
You going in? So we're standing here in a place called the Crab Pool in Salt Hill. We're looking across at the Burren. Right out to our right-hand side, we have a headland called the Black Head. So this is sanctuary runners, but they're actually sanctuary swimmers. And they're here as part of a Swim Ireland initiative to get these into the waters. Yeah, so we have a real mixed bunch here. Having great crack, there was a little bit of nervousness about the coldness of the wild Atlantic waters on day one, but we've all got used to it. They're learning how to swim, they're learning about currents and stuff like that. Right, let's hit the water, guys. Hat for this man.
Start splashing yourselves up, getting the hands, the back of the neck.
It's tropical, it's like Barbados.
Come on, let's get wet, guys. Face wet. I don't want any funny faces. Just get down, please. We're gonna get our legs up now, remember? We're gonna get nice and relaxed. We're gonna look at that lovely changing sky as it changes from blue to black to white. Toes up now. Come on, let's go. Give me those toes. Right, rough and right.
As the class swims out further, back on the beach, I meet Jennifer O'Brien. She's been helping to bring the Sanctuary Runners Project to the sea this summer.
So we're in week three of four of taking the Sanctuary Runners concept to the sea with Sanctuary Swimmers. And so Sanctuary Project is all about community integration and bringing people together. So the group are made up, we have people from the local community, we have people who are migrants to Galway for different reasons, we have people from direct provision centres here. So there's a huge piece about bringing people who, I suppose, are in emergency accommodation centres out to enjoy, to meet other people, to meet other migrants who've made their home in the area that they're based in, to meet other Irish people in an informal setting where we just get to have a chat as friends.
What plans are there for this kind of project across Ireland?
So we see the benefit of having experiences like this nationally. It was great to have a successful pilot last year and to be able to build on that this year with locations like Galway and Cork and Dunmore East and Bray as well. You know, the sea is there for now. It'll be finishing up next week and we'd love to see something up and running. Or for the people who are participating in this course, as is to feel, have that sense of confidence to go out and to enjoy the amenities that are on offer where they live.
How are you feeling?
Oh, I'm really good. Actually, the water's not so bad. Only now I'm feeling cold, getting out of the water. But yeah. Today was a great session. I want to stay in there. All the time that I've been coming here, I've been swimming with a float, using a float, but today I was swimming hands-free.
And you had wind, rain, and sunshine.
Yes, and a rainbow. Did you see that rainbow? Yeah. We had like three in one at the same time. I got to get out of my comfort zone to go from one end to another end. I did it pretty good and I stepped on a jellyfish and I was paranoid the whole time in the water, but I think it was great, exquisite. And the water was warmer than I expected it to be.
You're going to get a cup of tea now.
Oh, definitely, I'm looking forward to that.
Do you want to leave the tea bag in?
While the swimmers warm up on shore with a hot cup of tea, they tell me how they've been finding the lessons.
My name is Tamara and I'm from Zimbabwe. I'm living in one of the centres and here in Galway. Like swimming, I don't even know how to swim, so I saw this as an opportunity for me. Yeah, my anxiety was really high, but they taught me how to calm myself, so it made me feel peaceful and calm as well. So,
yeah. Okay, I'm Sam from Nigeria. Yeah, I could say I'm trying to face my fear because I was afraid of going to swim.
How do you feel in the water now?
Yeah, I feel so much better. Like it's so soothing and relaxing for me. No worries, literally.
Your head feels clearer.
Yeah.
You've got your biscuits.
Yeah, I got my biscuits.
How are you feeling?
Much better, much more confident. It's lovely to swim when it's raining. I feel like a salted barbecue because I'm too salty.
Do you want milk?
I've been here for 6 months in Saltier, just around here.
How are you getting on in the lessons?
Oh, they are quite good. Learning new things. Mingling, socializing. Yeah, island is lonely. So meeting new people every day, it's quite a great thing.
How did you get on?
I learned 2 strokes today. So next week I'll be on 5. And I left my son, I even forgot about him.
You left your son. So you took some time for yourself tonight?
Yes. Yes. It was my me time. Time alone without him. Yeah.
So you'll be back next week and back in the water?
Yes, definitely. Definitely. I'm coming back.
Great stuff there from Della Kilroy with the Sanctuary Swimmers Group in Galway. And there are now groups actually in Bray, in Myrtleville, in Cork, in Dunmore East, in Waterford, and in Dollymount Strand in Dublin. For more information, go to sanctuaryrunners.ie. Now, nearly all babies are born in hospitals today, but it wasn't always like that. Not too long ago, and you're talking about the last 60 years or so, the midwife, wearing a navy gabardine coat and travelling on a bicycle, medical bag in hand, was a very well-known figure across parts of rural Ireland. And to remember that era of home births and the role of the midwife, the National Museum of Ireland Country Life in Mayo is planning a major new exhibition. And they need your help to gather stories and objects associated with these women to get the conversation started. And they're having a seminar later this month all about it. Emma Laffey is going to be there. She's a maternity healthcare assistant in Galway and in her spare time, a volunteer with the Skahana and District Heritage Group in County Galway. And she's been researching the story of An Bhean Gluna, as they're called, from the 1800s to the modern day. Good morning, Emma.
Good morning, Ella. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you so much for joining us. We know today there is a very small percentage of women who do give birth at home. But in the past, I mean, this was the only option available to women. And it was the midwife who came to the house to help.
Oh, it was. It was their only option. And at one time, they were known as the handy women. There was no qualifications or any skill training put into it. It was just a learned skill that they would have been passed down by a mother or an aunt. And every village would have had one across the county. And they didn't just do births, they did the deaths, or if there was any sickness or anything like that, they would be called on by their local people.
And it was sort of ad hoc, they had no qualifications, but then that all changed in 1918, I gather.
It did. There was a Midwives Act brought in, and they were told that they needed to get their certificates or they'd be illegal. They wouldn't be allowed practice around in their local villages. But it did continue right up until the 1970s in some places. And we had a lovely lady, Ma Kilcommon, she was fondly known as. Her husband was Pa, Ma and Pa, they called them. And she was still working up until the 1970s because there was a huge trust put into these handy women.
And sorry, go on.
They were loved and trusted. So and this particular lady was scrupulously clean. So she would have avoided infection really a lot of the time. So she had huge trust. And another name they had for her was Mrs. Come Quick.
I mean, pregnancy and birth, it's such a joyous occasion for many, but it can be severely impacted by poverty, by sickness, by mental health issues, by miscarriages. The midwives, I mean, they had to manage an awful lot, didn't they? It wasn't just the physical event itself?
Oh no, it was the mental aspect of it, anxieties as well, because during those periods, you have to remember, there was no medical intervention. So death was a huge part of their midwifery life. So they would have, if it wasn't the baby that would have passed away, it could be the mother as well. So it was a devastating impact on the family.
We might have a listen now to the voice of a very popular local midwife in the Ballinasloe area of East Galway. Her name was Bina Kelly, and she spoke to Jim Fahey back in 1983 on his Looking West programme, and she was at that stage 81 years old, and she recalled some of her memories.
Do you know, even there was a time, and the kiddies used to look forward, if one family got a baby, the others want one. And there was a time they believed, I got them here, and I'd have them in a box. But they'd come then to say that number one house got a baby. Well, number two and three'd be at my door going to school. They were walking to school that time and knocking. And they wanted a baby. Now, sometimes my brother met them and he said, oh, she has a box of them upstairs. Come back again, but she's out of here now. But in any case, they believed that it would be in the bag, the nurse's bag, under a headache cabbage. That was their idea at that time.
Bina Kelly talking in 1983 to Jim Fahey. Now, Bina's niece is Kate Noonan, and Kate joins us this morning. Good morning, Kate.
Good morning, Ella.
It's just such a lovely image that she paints there. It's, I gather she was quite legendary. The babies she delivered were called Bina's babies.
Absolutely.
Tell us a little bit about her. I mean, I suppose the bag itself, I can imagine as a kid, you'd be fascinated by what was in that bag.
Oh, yes. Now, I can't, because I was the youngest of a family of six. And, of course, she had delivered all of them, apart from me. Funnily enough, I was born in Portiuncla. But I was quite young. But I remember her coming back on her bicycle after being out on her case. She always referred, you know, when she'd go out to these ladies, that she was going on a case. And she'd come back and then she'd take off the gabardine coat and then she'd proceed to take out all the instruments out of the bag and sterilise them, and it was fascinating. Now, I never saw a baby, but then, you know, that is true. Most babies, because times are very innocent then, I don't think it would happen now. They all thought that the babies came from Bina's bag. It's very funny.
I just wonder, I mean, Emma, you might know the answer to this. How did women and the community get the word out to these midwives that they might have needed help and they were about to give birth?
They would have literally, somebody would have ran over, a young boy would have ran over, they would have called for a hackney, or most times it was a horse or an ass and cart. They'd call to the house and pick her up and bring her over. And they could be up to 2 or 3 days sometimes with these labouring women, especially if she was a first time mother. And it was hardship. Wind, rain, hail or snow, they had to go.
They got on that bicycle.
Yeah, out they went.
Kate, you were, as you mentioned, your aunt didn't deliver you. When you had children, did you draw on any of the stories that she told you, her expertise?
Oh, well, you know, I wouldn't have lived very close to her at that time. You know, I was probably, you know, lived many places, but in Limerick when my first two were born. And I'll always remember bringing my firstborn son, Alan, to see her when he was only probably just weeks old. And she was always, you know, she had a marvellous pair of hands. And she, you know, would catch the baby's head and twirl it around. And she said to me, you know, oh my goodness, he's got a double crown, you know. And I said, really? And she said, yes. And she said, that'll mean this young man will travel far.
Uh-huh. And did he?
I'm thinking, well, it took him a hell of a long time. I used to wonder as the years went by, you know, what the heck was Bina talking about? You know, this fella hasn't gone outside, you know, Galway or Dublin. But then, lo and behold, I think he probably in his late 20s, early 30s, he took off to Australia with friends and travelled all over Australia and ended up, I think, on the Great Wall in China. And then returned, and a few years later, he married a beautiful Balinese girl. So
she was,
you know,
right.
She got that right. But that was my everlasting memory of her. And, you know, my most precious memory was, you know, my father and mother, we would drive out there and maybe an autumn evening or winter's evening, and one evening we walked in and here there was a circle of lovely traveller ladies with their newborn babies, all Bina's babies of course, sitting around an open fire, and she had a zinc bath set up on two chairs, and there she was demonstrating how to bathe the babies. And of course, oh my goodness, I thought I was, oh, my Christmas had all come together, because I could never understand how my mum couldn't get a baby from behind his back. So I spent the evening holding these beautiful little babies and seeing them being washed and dressed and put back under their mum's shawls, as they all wore shawls in those days. I remember that as a very, very precious memory.
Such incredible images you're creating there. And Emma, I know that you put the word out that you were looking for memories, and you've had, you know, people contacting you, showing you the medical bags being the main thing from the midwives that they know. And I know through your children, you are related to someone who called Mary Kate Jennings from Ballinasloe, and you have her medical bag as well. I'm very grateful to both of you for joining us this morning. Emma is going to be speaking at the National Museum of Country Life at Turlock Park in Castlebar on August the 20th. For more details, go to museum.ie. And we also featured it a while back, but in the context of midwives, it's probably worth saying again, the Leitrim Women's Pop-up Museum, which includes stories of these midwives, will be open on August the 14th in Manor Hamilton from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. Both these events are very much worthwhile going to. So thank you so much, Kate Noonan and Emma Laffey, for joining us this morning. Brian Moss was our broadcast coordinator. Liam Mullen was on sound. Eileen Heron produced. I hope you all stay safe out there. Have a great weekend, and we'll talk to you next week.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1. Listen back on the RTE Radio Player.